City of Gustavus City Council. And as usual, during the work session, we will review the general meeting agenda and packet. Tonight, we have in addition to that, and I hope we could go forward first, we have some members from the Department of Transportation who reached out to talk to us about opportunities for local communities to participate in grants and forgivable loan programs affected by emergent contaminants to install or expand public water systems, in particular, the PFAS-related funding technical assistance. And I will look and see when I'm looking for Melanie Bray and Aurora. Okay, I see that Aurora is here. And don't see
good evening.
Okay, hi, Aurora.
Hi, nice to see you all.
Okay, do we want to ask folks other than the DOT people to turn off their videos? Will that be necessary? For those of you in the audience, if you could please turn off your videos to, we have a little bit of difficulty getting enough connectivity or whatever, some magical thing to allow us to everyone to participate. Okay, there's Melanie. So Melanie is the Department of Transportation statewide PFAS coordinator replacing Sammy Cummings, and we've invited her tonight to come talk to us about PFAS grant issues and funding issues and whatever she can tell us. And there may be other members as well that will be here. So Melanie, would you like to go ahead and start?
Sure. I think both Aura and Kristen are on. Marcus was going to try to attend if possible. We'll see if he makes it. To start with, I just wanted to introduce myself to everybody. My name is Melanie Bray, and as it was noted, I'm the statewide aviation PFAS coordinator, taking over for Sammy Cummings. And first off, I want to thank everybody for their patience when we had that small gap between the time Sammy left and I started working. I know you've been very patient with us to get on waiting on information and working together to see how we can move forward. One of the things that we wanted to discuss and just reconnect with everyone on where we're at with the long-term solutions, the short-term solutions, maybe looking at some recapping of ideas moving forward that maybe weren't as interesting or a possibility in the past, and to just brainstorm what we need to do moving forward and see where the community and where the council is at with their idea on what the needs are for this work. We do know that cisterns, the progress has not been moving forward on that. And one of the things that we wanted to say is that we have heard the residents. We've talked to Senator Keel's office. We understand that this is just, it's a terrible solution or lack of solution and seems to have been kind of put into a holding pattern. I want to say that we are moving forward. I am looking at funding sources, and our plan is to move forward to see what we can do to work on getting a design for a cistern, something that Gustavus Construction can use moving forward, and working with them to get the cisterns completed that are partially built or haven't been started yet. We know that there's been some concerns with the lack of movement with Hillary Lesh's cistern as well as Kelly McLaughlin's. And we too are looking at that and looking at moving forward and how we can find funding to make those solutions happen. One of the areas that is a little on the back burner seems not to have been able to be finalized is a secondary water source. We've been talking about that supplemental well that was initially started with Gustavus Construction and now doesn't seem to be moving forward as was originally planned. And one of the things that I wanted to hear from the city council was your thoughts on that supplemental well and with the installation of the cisterns. And is that still one of the ideas that you have moving forward? In addition to those, are there other options and discussions that you've had to a long-term water solution?
Okay. Are you looking for questions now from the
Uh, since
commission
this was a
panel?
working session, we kind of were working on the idea that there would be some back and forth and some communication. So if you had questions, like Aura.
I can help out. Hi. Thanks for having us here. I several hats working with y'all in Gustavus, and HDR is working to support the funding source identification for PFAS issues across the state. I'm with HDR. I'm the Alaska grant lead, and is it okay if I screen share for a minute? I can do that. Okay, so I was just going to show you a spreadsheet of what we have been doing as we've been looking at PFAS sites that where DOT is responding across the state, and we've been looking at all the different fund sources potentially available for long-term solutions for setting up water systems that match a community's needs and match the requirements or the needs in the community from a PFAS contamination standpoint. And there are quite a few new sources of funding available that have been made available in the last couple of years. There is extra money through the bipartisan infrastructure law, extra funding from other fund sources, including formula funds that can go to states to support with addressing PFAS contamination. This is a very large focus for the Biden administration, and there is money mojo behind getting folks to have clean water on a long-term basis. And so we have a very large spreadsheet of a number of different programs that are available. And I from a business standpoint, we can sort of dial in which programs are available for communities with the demographics that of Gustavus or the incorporated non-incorporated characteristics, whether you have a public water source or not. And so we've been able to kind of narrow down to a certain number of grant and funding programs. Some are funds that would come from the Biden administration through the state through formula disbursements. Some are competitive grant programs, some are loan programs. And it kind of leads us to us, the like not HDR DOT, but like just as a whole to a conversation about what are some of the options that might or might not work for the city from a business standpoint, and thinking about what are the long-term solutions that would fit best for Gustavus. And so in order to match a project to funding that's out there, it's really important to identify exactly what's being funded and what the project schedule and timeline might be on. And it's okay if there's, it's not started, right? But just to be able to know what you're trying to fund and when. And so, I know just from having worked at DOT and having, just knowing Gustavus a bit, I've been in Juneau 25 years. There have been a number of different discussions that have been held around what might happen long term, in Gustavus. And so I think, it would be really, from a fund source identification standpoint, I have these questions of, what are we looking to fund? And I kind of want to ping Kristen Freiberger in to just kind of maybe talk through some of the different options that have been discussed in the past. And then I have some, like, I can give you some leading questions that might help with the discussion here. Yeah. So Kristen, can I tag you in?
Aurora, real quick, if you wanted to share your screen, I did make you a co-host, so if that would help as we proceed, you can do that.
Sure. Okay. So what I'm sharing here, you're probably not going to be able to read at the scale that's very useful, but I will just show you that there are quite a few of agencies, DOI, EPA, EPA to DEC, HUD, USDA Rural Development, Rural Utility Services, NOAA, et cetera, grant programs that all fund different slices of PFAS-related work. And so kind of the point of showing you this is that we want to, before maybe making suggestions about what might be some funding pathways for some of the solutions in Gustavus, we want to dial in a little more what exactly you want to see happen in the community. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know, Kristen, if you want to maybe just give us the like historical snapshot of what's been looked at and what we know some of the concerns are and like, what we don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, I think everyone probably knows me at this point, but Kristen Freiberger with Shannon and Wilson. As you guys know, we're the ones that come out and conduct the sampling and are aware of, what the results are associated with that and assist with finding alternative solutions associated with all of these projects. So there are several different types of solutions that we look at whenever we first are starting projects like this. The most common one is called a POET system. That's a point of entry treatment system. One of the reasons we did start going down that path in Gustavus with the Gustavus End and putting in a point of entry treatment system. But one of the disadvantages to that for this community specifically is that there's a lot of maintenance costs and time associated with maintaining systems like that. So since we're looking at individual homes needing that, it's just not as appealing of a solution for, say, the Gustavus community, because the average homeowner, that's going to put a lot of strain on them to be able to maintain that system and the time. A lot of times when we're talking for POETs, we're looking at bigger systems, such as, let's say, for example, the city of Fairbanks. They're not one of our clients, but just saying, like, if they had a PFAS issue, we'd start talking to them about putting a POET on the wells that they're already using to supply out to the entire community. That's one system, one need for maintenance, and that's much different than, say, Gustavus, where we don't already have a water system in place. And when you are looking at POETs, there's several different options that you can look at, and it really comes down to the media that's being used in the past. GAC was really the big one. That was what we had put in at the Gustavus Inn. But through the development of the science associated with PFAS, we've begun to understand that GAC is probably the least favorable, just because some of those PFAS compounds will break through, specifically the small ones. They'll break through pretty fast. And so that's not the direction a lot of people are going to ROs, or even a media called ion exchange. Like I said, though, for Gustavus, it's probably not as favorable, given it does put quite a heavy burden on the individual community members. Other things that we have done and looked at in association with different communities and then in Gustavus is obviously the cisterns, the rain catchment that you guys are all aware of. And that seems like the most favorable option. But really, one of our goals for this meeting on our side is to really understand what it is that your community desires. What is it that the direction that you guys want to go? Are you happy with the cistern? Associated with the cistern, we were putting in a supplemental well in case there are periods of low rain or high water usage. Similarly, we have some communities where we've looked at holding tanks. Those are typically in situations, again, where we have a water source that we can deliver from. And that's been something that's been favorable to various community members. And then, you know, the biggest thing that we've done in some of the other communities, at least, is connections to the water line. So in Fairbanks, when we were detected PFAS in wells for people next to the airport, there is a water line available in Fairbanks. And so we were able to extend that and connect them also similarly for in Anchorage. So those are really the options that typically come up when we're talking about private wells that have been impacted. Gustavus is a unique situation because there isn't already a water distribution system in the community. And so I guess with that, maybe Aura and Melanie, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and toss it to the community members. Aura, go ahead.
Yeah, can I just frame one thing? You know, there are different sort of sources of funding in terms of like who can be responsible for funding or who can access funding. And so, you know, a lot of what's happened so far has really been through DOT and then their avenues, or Department of Risk Management and their avenues for funding. And the reason to really have more of a like open conversation, I think, with the city of Gustavus is because there are significant fund sources that the agencies can't access that you guys as a community can access and leverage. And so it's like, wow, is there a partnership here that we can put together to help bring in funding to move forward in a very substantial, highly funded way to bring in some long-term solutions? So that's kind of the genesis of the conversation. And so, you know, I guess I had talked to Kathy just very, very briefly, just kind of like, what are some of the parameters of what works and doesn't work? She said, as you know, as so many communities say, is like, hey, we don't have staff or we don't have the ability to do long-term maintenance. So like that has to be a parameter. So I'm really curious, what are some of the other sort of like business parameters that need to be kept in mind when looking at options for long-term solutions and fund sources?
And Kathy? Haleri, our city administrator.
This is Vice Mayor Brian Taylor. I appreciate the discussion so far. I'm curious, so when you say long-term solutions, are you hinting towards us eventually establishing a municipally managed water utility as kind of like the end result here? Because that's not something that we've necessarily discussed at length. So we don't have really like a plan in place for how we would move in that direction. The discussion that we have had on that subject, I would say, has leaned mostly towards that not being something we currently have a fiscal plan towards the maintenance needs of. So I think you've kind of identified most of what we've already discussed on this. So it does seem like the individual solutions like cisterns, something that we can do on a house by house basis, kind of is the most realistic for the community at the moment. Obviously kind of hard to say long-term, but I don't think any of us have like a vision right now of Gustavus operating a water utility at the moment.
And that's because of like long-term sort of O&M costs associated or what are the elements there that are the concern elements?
Go for it, Kathy.
If I might. So having run training for the wastewater and water treatment operator program when I was up north, I mean, it's a huge undertaking. Even if we were to have a single point water system that people could come and, you know, fill up a tank in their truck and bring to their homes like they do in Fairbanks, I mean, we would have to, like Brian said, undertake an entire city utility and training program. We'd have to have staff for it, and the liability that the city would have to incur for something like this, given our past problems, would be huge. And so it's not something we've entertained at this point, because individuals were receiving assistance. I know the standards and the thresholds have changed, which could change the whole game. But as Brian said, we have not entertained having, you know, the staff nor a department to be able to put something like that together. I understood that at some point that a private entity such as Gustavus Construction might be willing to put together some sort of water treatment system, which would be available to community members. And it would also help during times when, if the cisterns ran dry or something similar. So we're not in a position. It's a huge undertaking, and we are not in a position at this time to even look at some of those funding sources without the consideration long-term of undertaking our own utility for it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm hearing cost, liability, training, just like the structure, everything that kind of goes into running a utility.
Staffing. I mean, we would have to.
Staffing.
My understanding is we'd have to establish like a public works division of the city. And I mean, maybe I'm having a little bit of hangover from our last town hall where we got a lot of very strong feedback about already having too many employees for our amount of tax revenue we bring in. So there's a little bit of concern around, you know, how would we do something like that and make it sustainable? Because obviously this is not a decision you can take back, but I don't expect that, you know, there's grant funding available for, you know, 20 years of operational costs or something like that. So
yeah, that's a big concern with the fund sources that are available right now, for sure. For sure. And then, you know, from a fund identification standpoint, there might be partnerships that, you know, could be entered into between like the city and the private entity where, you know, there's a proponent of an application who isn't the actual responsible party for down the road. So that's an idea potentially for an arrangement that could help support a private entity developing a water treatment system.
So generally in these funding sources that you're seeing, are there more opportunities available for these kind of larger systematic solutions, or because it seems like that's sort of what you're trying to lead us towards here. And I wonder if that's because there's more opportunities in that area, or if because it's just like more of a hassle to do the smaller scale cistern, like house by house work.
So individual people and private businesses are not generally eligible applicants for these fund sources. Mm-hmm. The funding need is at a scale where there's a one-off, like house by house approach probably has some, there's economy of scale for trying to sort of bundle some approaches potentially. I think, you know, I don't know if I'm trying to lead one way or another, other than I'm coming from what the funding sources kind of go to. And they do look at more systematic approaches. There are definitely funds available for non-public water sources and non-system sources, with the recognition that there are areas impacted specifically by emerging contaminants that aren't in systems. But it's kind of, you know, it's that you're asking an interesting question from a business model standpoint, right? And that's the question we have to get to of what to look for you.
Yeah. It's definitely, I can see where you're coming from, and it's just more efficient to try kind of work things at a systemic scale as much as we can. Is there an opportunity available for us to potentially like act as the city? I mean, even this might be a large project, but something where we can maybe aggregate need inside of the city from, you know, multiple homeowners or individuals underneath the city somehow in one application. I'm trying to think of how we can aggregate this and, you know, work with that economy of scale, but still operate in the way that Gustavus is built.
Right. To really honor sort of what your governance needs are. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it would have to be maybe like a nonprofit or a government entity that would be an eligible applicant for this. But it could be a pass through to another entity to actually deliver the project.
Interesting. Go for it, Kathy. I see.
Well, the other consideration is, I mean, you know, even if we could build a pipeline from, you know, Falls Creek into town for a central place. I mean, we're so spread out and have so many miles of road here. you know, people live on 2, 3, 4, 5 and more acres, and we're so spread out that it's just not realistic to think about having a water system in this vast area going to individual houses. We're not talking about a village like Wainwright where all the houses are clustered within 3 miles of each other. We're talking about a vast expanse of land and, you know, various water levels and tables to deal with. So that's a huge concern too.
Yeah. What about, and maybe this is a question for Kristen. Kristen, are there potential locations for centralized wells?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the further away from the airport, the better. So closer, I'd say west of the river would be, you know, if we were to go down this path, I would suggest west of the river, which does seem to be a little more central to the community, at least for the majority of the community.
And with some sort of like delivery service kind of using that, how that would work?
Yeah. So that's how I envision a system, not necessarily how you were describing it, Kathy. I think we would agree that water lines probably aren't the best option at this state or this stage of the situation, but something, yeah, that water can be delivered from is more likely to be favorable in the community.
Off the top of your guys' heads, asking the other counselors in the room, do you guys recall if the Gustavus PFAS Action Committee is an NGO, registered NGO, or are they just a committee of, I don't know if they're a registered organization, I'm just thinking of.
I don't think so. I don't think they're active right now. We could, they could undertake.
Oh, I'm not sure if they if they're the perfect organization for it. I'm just thinking of potential ways we could, if we can figure out a way to get funds in the community for any kind of system, whether that's, you know, aggregating funds into one application and trying to do more, you know, holding tanks in a central point and distribution systems, or even just getting funds to put cisterns in affected properties, which is probably the most kind of realistic for our geography and the rain we get, etc. But if they're saying we've got a, or our easiest way would be, you know, to put, at most act as a pass-through or do the application and have an NGO or a non-governmental organization, yeah, run this.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that this may be an opportunity for us to meet as a smaller group of council members, and or I think rather than, I feel like there's a lot of detailed information that we need to absorb and discuss. Do you have any thoughts on this, Kathy?
I mean, the Gustavus PFAS Coalition did a lot of legwork on this, and they understand probably better than most of us what some of the potential, you know, drawbacks or positive, you know, things might be for that. But again, it's a massive commitment on behalf of the city when so many people, you know, already have their own wells and water systems. And so, I mean, I wouldn't even envision if we had a central water system that there would be delivery. People would come like they do in Fairbanks and fill up their tanks and, you know, take them to their houses. And that's even if we ended up with a central water system.
Yeah.
I do have a question, though, from Kristen. I know, yes. DOT didn't include in their budget continuation of testing the test wells that are around town and maintaining that data. Have you heard anything otherwise? Have they changed their mind on that? Or, I mean, continuing to collect that data rather than building, I mean, building a water system is one thing, but maintaining that data stream is pretty important. And I'm just wondering if you've heard whether or not they will, are apt to continue with that program.
So, I mean, the way things stand at the moment, the sampling is not something that'll be prioritized for the purpose of continuing the trend analysis that you're talking about. And that is, it really just comes down to that there's a limited amount of funding and the priority has to be on giving people, you know, better drinking water and not having this continuation of temporary water solutions that sort of drag out. So at this point, no. Melanie can speak for DOT, but you know, if there were more funding available, then sampling would certainly be part of it. But that's really just what it comes down to at this point, is that the funding source is very limited. And so there's had to be some prioritization of various tasks.
Thoughts I have too about no matter the scale of the system or systems is how do we ensure purification and liability issues?
Okay.
On which type of systems are you looking at the cisterns or a well?
Well, anything that's an aggregate system, you know, where you're distributing, you know, the if the city becomes responsible, you know, for ensuring multiple community members, you know, purity of the water, apart from their having individual cisterns and being responsible individually.
Okay. I'm making, as I were taking notes, I'm making a matrix here of concerns of like elements that to answer when looking at any particular funding source. So great. Thank you for that. How to ensure purification, how to make sure that water is actually clean and who's responsible for that.
Yeah. You know, what might be good is for us to maybe schedule another opportunity, you know, maybe a town hall or another session, or perhaps you know, smaller group. I think we probably don't have the time tonight to kind of have a full work session on developing the details.
Agreed. We could take your whole evening going mm-hmm. through a bunch of this. Really quick to answer your, or not answer, but to expound on your query. One of the things that we were particularly interested in is if Gustavus would be interested in knowing more about a well and what purification, you know, what POET system might be required for that. We could look into if it was a private entity, like if, I don't know whether a nonprofit could own a well, like a bingo hall type of thing, and run it instead of the community, or if you would want to have it run through the city of Gustavus, and, you know, what would we be looking at for that? Funding opportunities for the city of Gustavus would be one of the areas Aura could look into is, you know, what we would look at is, would this be a well that people bring their own tanks to and fill to bring back to their cistern? Or would we be looking to see if we could find a funding source to help provide a water delivery truck that could be on call or move around through the community and disperse water as needed? We could look at all at several of those things, and each of them would probably have a different type of requirement of liability and staffing and maintenance and operation needs. But if that is something you would like us to even examine, we'd be more than happy to work with you on answering a few more questions that way.
Janine, I think you had your hand up.
So I have a question for Kristen. Do you know from the research how many families or households we are talking about in Gustavus that have been impacted, that first of all have had cisterns or other things put into place, and how many others are still waiting?
That's a good question. I do have a PDF up here that I can reference. So under the current drinking water limits, which is the 70 parts per trillion, there are 23 impacted locations. I typically talk in locations because some of those are commercial and some of those are residential. And I will say several of them, just based on the setup, didn't need a cistern. So those aren't getting cisterns. And then, sorry, I got to look at my update here, and it's in really tiny font. I know there's 6 that are in the works right now, and I believe, Melanie, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there was 7 that were complete at this point.
If I might there's a woman here in Gustavus who monitors a lot of this and has plotted a lot of her own information with well sampling and results around town. And she had sent an email in saying she doesn't know how the state would respond for the affected wells in Gustavus, but that it now puts more than 20 more wells above the limit in all three plumes if you're going to be looking at the new standards.
Yeah, so you're talking about the EPA's MCL and the announcement they came out with a couple weeks ago. So we're certainly aware of that, and we've been talking to DEC to understand, you know, what that's going to mean for Alaska and their drinking water limit, as we are still currently under the 70. We are anticipating that they're going to be coming out and aligning with the MCL within the next couple of months. They got to go through the regulatory process. And we've been doing some assessments of our database, and you are right, it's somewhere around another 20 or so locations that would be considered impacted under that MCL. But right now we are just looking to DEC to give us some guidance on when that new standard is going to be applicable, because there is always the chance that they could modify it a bit.
Understood. To get back to what you were saying earlier, Melanie, as far as, you know, whether there's interest in town here of what solutions we could explore, I'd say, at least from a personal perspective, I'm certainly interested to know, you know, what kind of funding could be available, and if there's something that we can find that's like right on the margins of what's realistic here in Gustavus. If it had to be a systemic system or systemic solution, it strikes me that we'd probably be looking at something where, like what Kathy has described, where we have like a central distribution location and people probably bringing their own jugs or tanks to that. Or, you know, if we can find something, any funding source, whether that has to go through an NGO or otherwise, for a way to aggregate individual solutions, you know, on a home by home basis, that would be, or even, I mean, alternative things. With one of the things that we discussed as a, well, I can't remember the last time we had a PFAS presentation, what was it that Kelly was saying? We could run an initiative to give people Berkey filters in town, or, you know, activated carbon filters that they could have in their home for drinking water. And, you know, we could subsidize that some way. So, I think we're open to any solution that actually seems kind of long-term workable here. You can tell, mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of wariness around getting too committed to something that's going to have major liability or staffing costs. But I think from my own perspective, I'm certainly curious to know what there is available. Cause I think that helps, I can help guide the discussion a little bit more around whether or not it's worth pursuing some of this.
Can I ask a question similar to that, in that I want to understand what options are legitimate? So in my experience in Gustavus, it would appear that there aren't many trucks. People tend to have, you know, hatchbacks and things like that. So for that reason, I've often thought that delivery type option made more sense. But can you guys sort of calibrate my thinking on that with, is that accurate or?
I think that's something that could, I mean, that we certainly have a business in town that does fuel delivery. So that's a model that exists and does operate here in town. We did just have him here in the town hall the other day telling us his trucks are breaking in half because the roads are so bad, but but there's that. So that's something that could work. I think you butt up against concerns again, against staffing and liability of who's going to run the truck. How are we going to maintain that? And where did the funding come from for that? So if you know, grant money exists or funding sources exist that can enable us to have some kind of a cushion where we could explore that, or like, you know, even a private entity potentially taking that on, where we have time to, you know, I guess corroborate with local entities that might consider doing that kind of work. But it doesn't strike me as something that the city's going to, you know, really eagerly jump into as far as expanding our organization.
But I do think that if we were looking at something in terms of a delivery system, it would be good to know what the options were if there was a truck available, because it does seem that that could, like you say, people are going more towards smaller vehicles. And so having a delivery truck as an option, I'd be very curious to know what it would, what it would cost, or if it was possible or something. I wouldn't write it off.
Yeah, neither would I.
And then I guess, can I ask one more question here? Just things that, you know, we've brainstormed over the years. In looking at locations that a well could be installed, that you set up, you know, maybe with a private entity, or let's assume a private entity for the purpose of this discussion. Is that something that the city of Gustavus would be willing to, like, do you have any land that you could offer for that sort of situation? We certainly went down the path of looking at state-owned land. Most of it's around the airport, so you can imagine that that is not favorable. You know, if we're talking about a well, we obviously want to be out of the area of PFAS influence.
That is a good question. I won't say that I'm the expert in all of our land holdings. You've already mentioned being west of the Salmon River, the best location. Does the city have any property on that side of any significant? I guess we're in City Hall, west side.
I mean, yeah.
City Hall's not
Mike Taylor is online, and he would be the person that could answer something like that. Again, I think the delivery truck is the least of our worries at this point. I think a system is a huge undertaking. The truck is ancillary to that and what we might decide to do with it. Mike would be the one to answer you about any city land west of the river.
Or the I area. Mean, just theoretically, if there was a good place, a part of land, would that be something that the city would be interested in contributing as like an in-kind contribution to an effort? The reason is if there's a financial contribution, it unlocks other sources of funding. And it also solves the problem of where to put something like that. So just theoretically, if there's a great place, is that something that's, and you don't have to answer right now, like commit to it. But just theoretically, is that something that could be on the table?
I see Mike has got his hand up, so I'll let him maybe expound on if there's a great place. I think we'd have to discuss a little bit further as to, you know, to give you a solid yes or no if that's necessarily on the table. But I mean, I'm certainly open to it, but I'm just one council member, so.
Uh-huh.
Go for it, Mike.
This Mike, other than City Hall and the park area around it, the city doesn't have any land on the west side of the river, and its largest piece of land is between is just south of Gustavus Road and to the west of Glenn's Ditch. So that's really too close to the problem area. There's plenty of land out there, but it's mostly privately owned. There's a lot of undeveloped land, so there'd be the possibility of buying a site, I suppose. And by the way, one other thing that occurred to me as we were discussing this and thinking about how many wells might need to be treated if you use POET systems on individual wells, it's important to recall that we have within the problem area, there are a lot of undeveloped lots that conceivably could be developed, and or there are some that have cabins on them that, you know, people aren't even really using except maybe vacation purposes and things like that. So there is potentially a lot more users in that area as the population infills those lots. But if you're looking for a site to the west of the river, I think we could go quite a ways west and be way out of the plume, but would probably have to buy some private property to do it.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Yeah, and I know, Mike, that you're aware of why City Hall wouldn't obviously be appealing with the known groundwater contamination there. So.
Correct.
As I think about fund source identification, it seems like maybe a small working group to kind of keep going to identify funds, the nexus of fund source and business considerations that work for Gustavus might be kind of a good next step. I think Melanie has suggested that, or maybe somebody, Gustavus suggested that. I think that's probably a good next step for continuing to explore and then dial in for what's really a serious potential for funding and for a structure, not and, a physical structure for, a, right. for us, for what might work for you. Yeah.
And within that work group, I wanted to say and continue to pique, you know, Mr. Taylor's curiosity and say, if there's something where you want to just see how it would play out and what the funding would be and what the roles and responsibilities are, you know, exploring these other options just to be able to go, we looked at it and that's not for us. That is a complete viable option. So with this well, you know, and looking at it, if it was a city owned well, if it was a private entity owned well, one of the things that I was going to point out, which may or may not change the parameters of maintenance and operations, would this be a full-time well use well, or would this, you know, originally the thought had been more of a backup supplemental well only used in times of drought or lack of rainwater for the cisterns. There's two ways to look at that. If people were concerned about the cisterns and wanted to have a holding tank, if a well was available for more frequent deliveries or drawing of water, is one method to look at, or just looking at it, you know, if your cisterns runs dry of 8,000 gallons of water, this would just be a way to, you know, to supplemental that. And it would not be a full-time usage, which could change some of the requirements and responsibilities as far as maintenance and operation goes for those things. So there's all kinds of little nuances and, you know, on options to go with that.
Sorry, this is the clerk. I think if we can start wrapping this up, because we are about 45 minutes in, it sounds like we're approaching a really good pausing point where they've given us a lot of information. Maybe we can talk about creating a special committee, maybe in one of our next general meetings to continue forward.
Thank you, Madam Cook. I agree. Thank you for the suggestion about the work group. I think that we haven't really come to sit down and talk about, you know, as Brian Taylor was saying, you know, sort of the significance of or the options, you know, of having a water system. So I think it's going to take us some time to do some research and to think about it. Thank you all for joining us tonight. We really appreciate the information.
Yeah, thank you guys for having us.
All right. Good night.
Stay dry out there.
All right. Thank you. I want to finish with you are more than welcome to poll us and ask us to come in and participate on subgroups or work committees for more information and just answering questions that you have as you work through this.
Appreciate that. You may help us sort of structure our thinking about this. Okay.
And we would really love to anytime you need us.
Okay, thanks, Melanie.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye. So we'll move on now to reviewing the meeting agenda for the general meeting next Monday, and the first item would be approval of minutes. Do any of the council members have any comments about any controversy about the minutes? I see shaking of heads. Number four will be off the agenda, guest speakers on PFAS, Madam Clerk. There'll be four reports, which we're not going to take tonight: disposal and recycling center, marine facilities, city treasurer, and city administrator. Other than your report next week, Kathy, is there anything that you wanted to mention now? You mentioned you may have some announcements or at least one.
Yeah, I got an update today about the law enforcement at the airport issue. Because of various union contracts, et cetera, the positions had to be reestablished through Department of Transportation and not with Department of Public Safety. They've been written up and formulated, and they're sitting on the chief of staff's desk for signature. They have individuals selected. I asked the question if that meant they were going to have to go out now and post for recruitment, and I was told no, but they had a lot of logistics that they had to deal with in terms of getting them the necessary equipment, you know, that they would need to have coming back and forth on the jet every day. You know, of course, they'll need uniforms and firearms and all of that. And so it's just waiting right now for signature. I've asked him to let me know by Friday if that hasn't occurred. And then once that is signed up on, then they will be moving forward with getting the individuals that were identified who are interested in the jobs.
Okay. And I understand that this, when you say the chief of staff, it's the governor's chief of staff. Yes. So it's at the governor's level now.
Yeah. And so it's there for now. He's working on it. If we don't hear it from them by Friday, we'll be contacting them.
That's ominous. Okay. Thank you. Okay. We have three non-code ordinances, and I wonder if City Treasurer Ben Satter can come forward and give us a brief description of these.
City Treasurer Ben Sadler, the first NCO number 9 FY24-12 is additional $8,000 that has been requested for phase two of the Salmon River Playground expansion. It'll be for the trail and the decking and maybe some picnic tables. Item 10, FY24-13 is $110,000 that's been requested for the landfill expansion. And for anyone online who hasn't been keeping up with that, that's just the where they're bailing now is filling up, and so they need to open up more area and including fencing and closing off the existing area. Item 11, FY24-14. That is moving $150,000 out of long-term capital projects back into the checking account to comply with the city's unencumbered funds policy. And we've talked about that quite a bit. If anybody has any questions, I could explain it again.
Thank you. Do any council members have any questions or comments? Okay. Don't see any online. Okay. Thank you, Ben. The next item will be the CY24-10 resolution asserting unfettered public access to the False Creek lands via the Hydro Road. As you recall, last general meeting, I made a motion to postpone it until the next general meeting. Both parties, AP&T and the Olneys and as well as the dispute resolution mediator have requested additional time in order to that they may see if they can reach a resolution or come up with solutions. So we're willing to give another month, postpone it. I'll make a motion. I shouldn't say we, because I'll be making a motion and we'll see if it's seconded and approved to continue it until the June meeting, and would like a condition that I would like to see is that there be no attempts to block vehicle access up the road during that time frame that the parties are conferring. Are there any comments or questions from council members? Okay.
Brian. I am a little curious on this. If you have any insight. So I feel like I'm maybe not understanding how us passing a resolution, kind of just stating the city's opinion on this matter, negatively impacts any discussions towards a resolution from the party. Since we're not really an involved party, we're kind of just stating our position and what we've seen. I'm curious if you have, are we just staying this because we've been asked to stay it and received some litigious verbiage, or is there? Because I guess it almost seems to me that having a resolution that clearly states the city's position could even be helpful to people who are trying to negotiate a solution, since the city isn't a direct party to what's being negotiated, but certainly has an interest in the outcome. It almost seems like the most formal way for us to contribute to that. So I'm curious if anyone has any or has heard more on how we benefit the situation by refraining from passing this resolution. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And no, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just wonder how long do we, you know, hold off on making our perspective clear in the name of hoping that a resolution, or I should say a solution to the issue comes around, because we're now getting close to a year and a half of hearing that something is coming and nothing has been coming. And if it turns into another summer of, you know, people not being able or being disinvited, but feeling unwelcome accessing their public lands via that route, then I think it's not something that we should sit idly by on and just hope that, you know, if we keep not doing anything, something will happen. Okay. So that's kind of my position on that, I guess I would say.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'll go ahead, Mike.
Yes, I think it's important for the city to set forth its policy clearly on this. And for the reasons that Brian has mentioned just now, it should be helpful to the other parties who are more directly responsible for solving this to know what the city's position is. And it gives us a basis going forward for any other discussions. We refer back to this. I'm not inclined to support a further delay. I think that this has taken too long. We're going into our third season, summer season, of the issues there on the road. And I would like to see it resolved. And it doesn't hurt for us to set forth clearly what our position is now, so everybody knows it, and hope that the rest of them can resolve it in the public's interest. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comment? No? All right. Well, we will take that up next Monday. Let's see, item 13 is the resolution establishing a conservation lands committee. And we had raised this to develop a committee following an interest in preserving the Gustavus Forelands. The mission of this committee, it will be to provide recommendation strategies and supporting documentation to the city on oversight and stewardship of conservation lands within the city boundaries. And the committee's efforts shall be limited to undeveloped lands recognized or formally identified for their conservation values. Developed priorities in city lands with industrial or intensive recreational uses are outside the committee's scope. Is there any comment or anyone want to discuss this? Any council members?
I am a little curious. So is this, we've already had, I believe, a working group that's been meeting on this?
They met twice. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not something I've been super involved with, but is this going forward going to be something that exists independently of the city, or do we have city councilors on this right now that are already kind of like advising this committee?
Mike Taylor and I have sat in on it. The idea of bringing the working group together was to get their recommendation on whether we needed a committee, and if so, what were the elements that they could recommend to us to go forward with.
Okay, so then going forward with this, I guess I should maybe just scan this and make sure I'm not missing anything. But is this going to be I guess I'm curious about what kind of entity we're establishing and who is on it and what that looks like long-term as far as the maintenance and operation of this organization. So is this like a city councilors only organization, or are we also inviting community members onto the committee that are unelected, and how that works?
It's a city committee. Okay. Not a city committee, I mean a community committee with I think probably no more than two council members sitting in, and it would be formalized, so they would need to provide notice and keep minutes and then report a minimum a quarterly to the council.
Okay.
We've had a lot of independent committees over the years and haven't had so many once we add the city administrator position. But this, so this is a little bit of a throwback.
Yeah.
When we have a need for.
Go for it.
So if you, Lisa Barker, city clerk. So there's two different kinds of committees we can have: a standing committee, which is routine, and then a special committee. Special committee, which I believe is what this will be. They have a purpose, and that's stated within this resolution. Once that purpose is met, then it'll be dissolved. And you can read about it in our ordinance. I would be happy to send it to you about the two different kinds of committees that we can have.
Okay.
If that would be helpful to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But they will be reporting to city council, as well as having a couple of city council representatives, as well as community members on it.
I guess I wouldn't see this as a standing committee, because I think that it's not, you know, like a particular project that needs to be accomplished and then set aside. I see this as, you know, providing longer term advice about.
Okay. So we can talk about that more before the general meeting, but I can send you the information about committees and how they're made and what the process is. So that way you can see it before the general meeting, if that'd be helpful.
Yeah, that would be helpful. So do we need to establish what kind of committee this is as we're establishing that the committee exists?
I don't think that's necessary. It's an advisory citizen. I don't think we need to, do we need to identify?
Yes. And Mike does have his hand raised, but it will need to either be a standing committee or a special committee.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you want to speak, Mike?
Yes, just briefly. If we have an official committee that's set up under the city, then it has to be an advisory committee, and of which there are the two types that clerk has mentioned. But it's an official committee that the clerk will put out a request for applications of interested city residents to join the committee. And the mayor would select from those a slate to recommend to the council to approve. And the council then approves the committee and I think approves the chair. And then the committee has to follow all of the open meetings requirements as an official advisory committee. But that makes us, this structure puts us in compliance with state law. So that's the way it's being set up.
That's great. I appreciate that. Sorry for making it clear that I had not read the "now therefore be it resolved" of this resolution. I'm just skimmed through that and see that this is pretty well laid out there. So apologize for my naivety.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let's see what we know. Looks like we're up to three more NCOs. And would the city, no?
We're at the budget. We should be at number 14.
Correct.
Sorry, I was skipping over that one pretty fast, wasn't I? Okay. It is an NCO. Okay. Would anyone like to provide an introduction to this?
Sure, I'll just say that after the town hall, we went back and we had basically three options for balancing the budget. We could cut, we could make more cuts, or we could use more interest, or we could. Well, that was really it. Those were the two options. So. What we did is we chose to take the remaining interest that I had not taken from the long-term capital projects. We used that $17,000 to balance the budget. I think it's about as good as it's going to get. But if anyone has anything they'd like to say about it, we can talk about it some more.
I do just want to express a little bit of concern on using or recognizing interest income specifically to fund ongoing operational needs. And I realize that it's super convenient for us at the moment where interest rates are sitting at, you know, we're making like 5.3 on the AMLIP, and this is probably close to, you know, 100 grand or more a year that we're pulling, actually maybe close to 200, depending on how much we have in AMLIP. But I do worry, you know, if we find ourselves in a low rate environment, or, you know, something happens and we need to draw on our savings and suddenly the interest income decreases, we put ourselves in a potential for, I guess it's not, you know, such a huge portion of the operating budget that we couldn't, you know, cut to bone on some things and go fine without it. But I guess I wonder if we're recognizing interest income, do we need to recognize all of it? It strikes me as a little bit, a little bit odd to recognize just whatever we feel of interest income into the operating budget. So, and I'm not a treasurer expert or anything on, you know, how that ought to go, but it makes me curious if you happen to know what is the total that we earned in interest on our AMLIP accounts and how much how much of that are we just leaving in place? Cause I still think we ought to have a discussion about how we assign what's left. Like we briefly mentioned putting some of that towards the gravel pit fund, or putting some of that towards the repair and replacement fund, or these funds that aren't going to be ongoing operational needs, but could use a little bit of bolstering. So I was hopeful that we would have more interest income that we could direct in that way, rather than putting it towards ongoing expenses, where we put ourselves in a little bit more of a precarious position, maybe not necessarily with $67,000, but I guess I'll stop rambling there.
Okay. So the total, if at the rate that we're receiving interest right now in our AMLIP accounts, if we took all the interest from the long-term capital project, the current capital project and the reserve, that'd be $89,000. We didn't take from the repair and replace or the gravel pit fund because we are trying to grow those funds. I don't have the number. I didn't write down the number that I put in to balance the budget. Mm-hmm. But whatever it was short of 89,000, but not so much. The reality of it is the reality of using the interest income. Yes, to answer your question, yes, we could put it all in there just so it shows that this is how much interest income the city has made, mm-hmm. or is expecting to make. Well, that's the thing, is it's not how much we're expecting to make. It's how much we made in the previous fiscal year. But we're not actually moving the money. So we're not taking the money out of the AMLIP accounts and putting that into the checking account to cover the city going forward. Because the amount of surplus revenue that we're hoping to make will cover the cost of doing business. How every year we have to do NCOs to move surplus funds into AMLIP. Now we'll just do NCOs to move less funds into AMLIP. We won't actually take the money out of AMLIP. So it will still continue to sit there. We'll still continue to gain interest on the interest that we have. So did that answer part of your question?
Kind of, yeah. It's always interesting to think about it from the flow of funds perspective.
Right.
I get stuck on, you know, annual budget versus right. like how it actually happens on a timeline like that.
So I think the thing that confuses most people, or that seems to from the questions and comments I get, and I'm not saying that this is what you're saying, but a lot of people see the budget as like, okay, now I have this much money in my hand, so I'm going to go, so this is what I can do with it. But a budget is really just a piece of paper that says, this is how much money I hope to make. So this is how much money I can spend, and not more. It doesn't really have anything to do with the flow of funds from one place to another. It's just a document that says, based on past experience, this is how much I should have at the end of the year. So this is how much I can spend. I can't spend more than that, or my budget's out of balance. And if, you know, the problem with a lot of government is that they start their fiscal years out of balance and they just keep going down. The good thing that Gustavus has managed to do over the years is not do that. We've managed to I don't want to say always, but I'm not aware of any time when we were budgeting less conservatively and we were spending more than we were making. And that's why we have this money in our AMLIP accounts now that we can use the interest from. So yes, I could have put the total 89,000, whatever, and then it would have showed us a surplus rather than zero, which was what we were hoping for. So does that better answer your question?
Yeah, that does. I still think that I'm trying to think of how we can maybe standardize this. I still worry a little bit about kind of like the slippery slope of using interest income and if that goes away, and if there's a way for us to, I don't want to say codify, but to establish some kind of policy or at least thought on, you know, so we come to this point next year, we don't say, well, let's do all of it because we need it. Okay. So because I think that's where we get to the slippery slope, and it might be worth, you know, defining specific AMLIP accounts where we say, okay, let's recognize the interest from X, Y, and Z AMLIP accounts, but we're not going to recognize the interest as income from the others because we in no condition do we want to take that. And then if that that means there's a surplus on the budget, I think that maybe is a more accurate, again, of course, it's all since we're budgeting expected income, you know, you can't necessarily predict what rates are going to do over the next year, but.
Right. And so there are a few things there. One is we've already done what you just said. So what I failed to do this year was I failed to say at a work session, which should have been the first budget work session, I should have said, the first thing we're going to do is go over the AMLIP accounts, because that's what the AMLIP policy that we passed at the end of FY23 said, was that at some point I would recommend to the council that we sit down and talk about the AMLIP accounts and what we want to do with the funds that are in it, including the interest. So going forward, I have a calendar of things to remind me of things that need to be done. And so next February, when we do the first budget work session, I've added to that calendar, discuss the AMLIP accounts. So it would be at that point that we would discuss, do we, you know, this is the interest rates. This is how much money we're making this year. Do we want to use that money in this way, or do we want to put that money into reserve, or do we need more for capital projects, or, hey, do we want to bolster the gravel pit funds or put the $27,000 back into the library repair and replace? That this should have happened. This being the first year, I just didn't know when it should happen. And after the fact, realized that, you know, it should have happened before we got to this point. So we do have a policy in place for that, and we will do that. And one of my concerns with bringing up using the interest in the first place was that we already have problems, not just amongst the council and the staff, but amongst the whole community over, well, now we've got all this money, you know, what are we spending it on? So by using the interest, it now says now we have another pot of money that we can grab from to add money into the, you know, the whatever that needs to be done. And so it was what the council and the previous treasurers have done is use the surplus, because then they could leave the interest and not have to worry about whether or not what interest rates are, but they knew that by budgeting so conservatively, they were going to have this surplus and they could use the surplus. So unfortunately, the way that we've done it this year is we've kept expenses rather high. We've budgeted less conservatively, and we've had to find a pot to pull from. And rather than surplus that we don't exactly know what it's going to be, we do know right now that we have that much in interest to cut to balance the budget. So that was the, you know, so that's what we did.
The bigger picture with AMLIP, and you know, I've sent emails on this, is to actually, I mean, besides this piece of it, is to have a larger discussion on our investment strategy and what we're doing moving forward. And I think that this brings up, you know, a time to maybe consider when and how we want to do that, because I think it's important that we don't just let it go status quo. I mean, I've signed off on his reconciliations where I've seen a big fat minus in there too. You know,
not from AMLIP. Not from AMLIP, just from the endowment fund.
Yeah, that would be the endowment fund.
Yeah.
The AMLIP is pretty
yeah, big. They're pretty good. So, but anyway, at some point it might be a good idea to have a few folks sit down and look at those things. The second part of that is this gets us to where we need to get to right away without worrying or wondering what our revenues are going to be moving forward to end out the year. So this is a more concise way to deal with the situation right now. We have made some, you know, some reductions, but throughout, but this gets us to a decent budget overall, and it's balanced. So moving forward,
and we will still have, carryover. There will be carryover funds that, you know, for mending the budget going forward. Once we're into FY25, we'll know how much money we've carried over, you know, where we want to put that money into the gravel pit fund, into the repair and replace fund, into whatever other things need to be done. The difference between the surplus and the interest was we know what the interest is. We just be guessing at the surplus, you know, knowing that we're going to get it, but not having a, like, I know that we have that money.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood. And I can appreciate that. I have wondered kind of often about the vagueness of, like, there will be surplus, but we'll just have right. to see.
And Shelley didn't like that either. And it's in the end, you know, even though the council has to approve it, it's the mayor's budget.
Yep.
And we won't probably have as much as we did because we don't have the federal funds that we had absolutely. For the last few years.
So. Yes, definitely not as much as we've had in the last few years.
Yep. So I do just want to, you mentioned $89,000 as the total interest we pulled on AMLIP accounts.
Is from that those three accounts?
Just those three accounts.
Right.
Okay. Great. So I guess I don't know how to schedule this, but I'd love to figure, like, so we haven't touched interest from AMLIP. I guess the three you've looked at is capital improvement, current, reserve, and
long-term.
And so, okay. So the two capital improvements and long-term. And that only puts us at $89,000.
Yep.
I am failing to understand how that is possible. Maybe this isn't the right time or place for this, but I'd love for you to send me anything you can on maybe if they have like a chart of their rates over the last fiscal year or, you know, the last 12 months. Cause I'm looking at that and seeing that that's almost $2.4 million and they're paying 5.3% right now. So that's like closer to 120 or 130 in my mind. So, but it could just be the rates were ramping up last year a little bit that we weren't quite at 5% all the way. So I'm just wondering how much, you know, if we were to get to a point where we start budgeting, you know, for future interest income, how that would look.
And I have it all on my desk. I can give you that. And one thing that I did point out to Shelley and Kathy, and, you know, we'll let everyone else know, is that in 2019 or 2020, those accounts that we're getting $5,000 a month on now, we were getting like $124 a month. So it's definitely not a long-term, this is where we're going to start funding the city of Gustavus from, but it was a solution for now to keep us moving forward without having to guess at the surplus.
Yeah, understood. Go for it, Janine.
So I have a question back on the road maintenance, and it's still not clear to me when at the city hall or the last meeting they were talking about the amount of money that was taken out of the budget and then it was told it was put back in. When I look at the budget from this year to next year, I see that the 24-25 says the total road maintenance is 165,000, whereas last year it was 196,000. And so I'm curious of the discrepancy there.
So we amended the budget when we knew how much with the original budget last year was $165,000. When when we knew what the surplus was, we amended the budget and added $31,000 more, and $15,000 of which was to show that we were willing to pay Glacier Bay Construction an additional amount of money because they were going to buy a new piece of equipment that was going to benefit the city of Gustavus. And the other $16,000 was for road maintenance projects. I don't remember the exact. Kathy says that she does.
Yeah. So the $15,000 was for reclamation of pulling the gravel off the sides of the road so that we could make sure that that happened area wide. And, we also had some additional projects, and we also had to pay a little extra for snow plowing this year. And so we had amended it to bring that up to a more realistic figure. And that's what we were hoping to do this year as well. When we first developed the budget, was because we're always NCOing money at the end of the year to make up for that. And I wanted personally to put in, I wanted us to put in the request of what it looks like it's going to cost. We're also going out with an RFP for a 2 to 3 year maintenance contract. And you heard some of the testimony about, you know, having to hire an operator and what the realistic costs are. I mean, they seem really steep, but when you ask any other business what it costs for them to have an operator on staff, it's significant. So we wanted to bring it more in line with what the real costs were going to be and make it evident to make sure that's, you know, how much money we wanted to spend and on our roads. Okay. And
so then to finish answering Janine's question, the original amount asked for this year was $215,000. And I pulled $50,000 out and took it back to the original request for FY24 of $165,000 because we had not yet figured, we weren't looking to use carryover and we had not yet decided on using interest. So that is where the change was it went from the original 165 last year up to 191, or if that's what the number was. This year they were asking for 215,000. I took it back to the 165, knowing that we could do a budget amendment later on. And then it was made it was brought to our attention that maybe we should put that money back in and figure out a way to fund it, not use it. It was, you know, I'll just say it was my mistake. I thought it was a good idea because it's easier to take one big lump sum out of one place than it is to take a lot of little lump sums and then put the little lump sums back in later on. And I just thought because the road maintenance was so big, it would be easy to take 50,000 out knowing that we were going to put it back in. I shouldn't have done that.
So I was following at first when you said that the budget for this year was similar to what was last year, except that last year had perhaps some one-time expenses that were in addition to the original budget.
Yes.
So I got that part. But then when you now went back to the $210,000, now you've lost me.
Okay, so that's for FY25. Kathy wanted to put in $215,000 for FY25 right off the bat. Right?
Right, and that's not there now.
It is there now.
It's there funded with interest income right now.
Yes.
So when I'm looking at the budget, it says 165. I have the wrong
plowing.
Total road maintenance.
Plowing 65.
I see 215,000 FY25 in the packet right now.
Yeah, I think that we need to go to the actual budget. I probably just haven't fixed it on the sheet. So if you go down to road maintenance.
So this is what's really frustrating. If I'm looking at the road maintenance and it says that there,
I see your computer,
trying to follow these budgets when the numbers.
Yeah, well, and that's, again, you know, I wish that I just made a mistake there. Mm-hmm. But I've made all these so that they all went 30. Together. Maybe I didn't fix the road maintenance. But if you look at it right there, 150,000 and 65 for 215,000. I'll fix that individual sheet. I'm sorry, I didn't.
So, all right, now this is making sense because if you go to the tab for the roads to look at the summary for roads, it's incorrect.
Yes.
This is the correct one. Okay, thank you. Now that makes sense because otherwise those numbers weren't jived in that I was looking at
and
the road section and it wasn't jived.
And I'm not sure when I sent that to you, but I fixed it on mine because I built up the budget narrative. I guess I just sent that to you before I fixed it.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So that makes sense.
So I didn't mean to cut you off there, Janine, if you have more to say on that.
No, you can.
I am kind of curious. So did you have off the top of your head what we budgeted last year for road maintenance? I guess, and maybe I'll finish my thought here. What I'm curious to see is where we have, you know, these total line items for FY25, be that payroll or, you know, total equipment, all of these, you know, dark underline and then the total beneath. I'd be really curious for our comprehension to get a delta there on how this has changed from the budget last year. And I know that, you know, the budget request each year doesn't necessarily directly map onto what we did last year, but I think that we look at historical trends pretty frequently to try and gauge how much we're going to earn and how much we're going to spend. So it makes sense to, I guess, so the question I find myself asking is, wait a second, we increased the road maintenance budget from last year. How much did we increase that? And all I see in this is the till now FY24 of 127,000. So I don't actually, I guess I can pull up the Excel spreadsheet and figure out how much we budgeted for last year, but it becomes a little bit of legwork for me to jump through and find, okay, so where?
Yeah. Right. So as I said in my email, I had to take that column out so that I could, build the budget narrative. It doesn't fit with the extra column. Mm-hmm. So, but if you go to the other two tabs, it's there. And I also said that I would send out an email with it back in. I took it out before I sent it to you guys. And I thought you shouldn't have done that because somebody's going to have a problem with this, but it was too late. But, but there's two other tabs that you can go to where that information is in the document. Or if you would have asked me, I could have emailed it to you with the extra column back in. We budgeted $165,000 last year for road maintenance. Then we amended the budget, and you said it was $191,000, mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
196.
When we change the budget, it's not just, we don't just amend it and whatever. We change it in all these other places as well, including QuickBooks. So at the end, when you see FY24's budget, you see the original budget with all the amendments that have happened throughout the fiscal year.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. I guess I might end up going through my own sheet here and just adding like another column with the change from.
That's what I would have done if somebody would have asked me to. I would have put it back in and copied and pasted it.
Didn't you already do that though when we first started working on this?
I did, and I took it out because I was building the budget narrative. Then I sent the email.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm asking for specifically is something I can just do on my own. So I apologize for not having taken the time to just do it. Is if we can potentially add maybe another column to the right that says like percent change from FY24. And then I could see that what we're budgeting road maintenance is 9.7% higher than last year. That way, just across categories, we can kind of get a quick reference. And I obviously understand there's, you know, limitations of space in the packet.
That's easy enough on a spreadsheet to do that.
Yeah. I'll have to go through and just do that on my own instead of asking you to do everything for me.
I mean, no, you know, I didn't, when we talked about making it so that the sheets added up and all in the same thing, you know, it's easy enough to do, just, you know, not that I have QuickBooks and QuickBooks has all that information, but nobody wants to look at it in a profit and loss format. So that's why you have it in an Excel spreadsheet. Last year I was told not to use the profit and loss as a thing. It has the percentages running down on the right to show you the difference. So there you go.
I guess any other comments on the budget at the moment? I will say that I feel like we've come to a pretty healthy budget here, for lack of a better word there. Maybe I'm glad to see it balanced, and I'm comfortable with how we've gone about doing it.
Okay. So I have a question about the 50,000 emergency funds and where that, so it looks like it got put into the budget last year and then it's in the budget this year. And where did that money come from originally?
It came from federal funds. I don't know if it was FEMA or what one of the state or federal pots that was giving the city money at the time when, you know, around COVID or the flood and COVID, everything kind of happened at the same time. I don't remember, but it was at that time that the city council said, hey, while we're getting all this money, let's take $50,000 and set it aside for an emergency or a disaster. And Mike might have said to me that it was Mike, if you'd like to explain, and then if that's not enough, I'll try to continue on.
Sure, I'll try. As I recall, we essentially just appropriated out of the revenues that we had a couple of years ago. And the reason that we did it was after the 2020 flood, when we were having to restore roads and so forth, we were we had to use or draw from the only or from our road maintenance funds as the only source for funding to fix those problems. We didn't, and if you are so if you have a big disaster of some kind, you could, and you didn't have funds set aside for a disaster, you'd have to impact severely road maintenance or wherever else you got the money from. So the idea was to have appropriated into our budget a budget line that was substantial that we could draw from immediately, that we wouldn't have to do another appropriation from our various saving AMLIP savings accounts, which takes a couple of meetings to do. We would have a budget line that we can immediately start drawing from and writing POs to, and we can spend money on a disaster, regardless of what it is, whether it's a road maintenance problem or a big tree falls across City Hall or the fire hall or something like that. We have a budget line that we can immediately tap, and the council doesn't have to go through the NCO process for it. And the idea further was that if we don't have that kind of event during the year, we would just carry that same amount over to the next year until such time as eventually we do have such an event. So it's there to make it possible for us to react immediately as a city to deal with a disaster and the damage from it.
Your mic isn't on.
Yeah, and just to add to Mike's point of having to be able to allocate it from that fund, having gone through, come in at the tail end of the whole FEMA process and looking at all of the invoices and things that you had to put together to get reimbursement from FEMA and trying to sort those out, which ones were not related to FEMA, which ones were related to regular road maintenance, which ones, the amount of time and effort that it took having to identify all of those expenditures out of the road maintenance budget was a nightmare. So having this specific fund for a disaster like that will make the accounting of something like that a whole lot easier than what we had to do before, which was really difficult to sort out. So,
and just the last thing, Janine, is that the only money that we carried over so far of surplus funds is the $50,000 to cover it. We carried it over last year and I believe the previous year as well. So it's we carry over the line item of expense and we carry over surplus funds. We budget surplus funds from the previous fiscal year to cover that cost.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
And so we've, as a council, have been putting a lot of emphasis on listening to the public. We've been having our, you know, the coffee with the council, and we've been asking for public input. And I think it's been great that we've been getting it. And so I'm going to bring up a topic of most of the public comments we've gotten in terms of written letters. And there's been at least five or more that have very passionately asked us to fully fund the library. And so I'm going to put in a push for that. We've gotten letters that have really talked about how the mental health of this community is based on the fact that the library is this space that anyone can go to. It's a place where you can walk in there and it's a safe space. It provides the mental health for this community. The library is something that is the heart and soul. It's been said again and again and again in these letters that we've gotten from the public. And so I think if we're putting out wanting to get information and feedback from the public, it's our duty. We should listen to what they're saying. And they're saying very loud and clear on these letters that they want to see the library funded. Then the amount that we're talking is a small amount of money in the big scheme of things. We've got over $2.5 million in the bank, and we're sitting here not going to be able to give an extra $3,000. And it's not even an extra $3,000 to be able to make the library budget what it's been in the past. And so it just seems to me that we have this money. if you want, you're talking about that there's a potential of carryover. Well, we've had two suggestions on how to fund the library. One was sent by a community member suggesting that we take the money from that emergency fund. And then when we get the carryover, it gets put back into it. And this way we are being able to provide the services that the community has come to expect and need and really benefit from. Kathy, you sent around a piece of paper that showed where the various communities, how much other communities spend on the library. Well, I looked at it closely. And if I were to think about any of the communities that fit our demographics and in the area, you look at Skagway, and Skagway is about twice the size of us, but our budget, it said the numbers were $115,000 and theirs was $300,000. So it seems like it's right in there in the ballpark. We don't have in our community, because we're not a Native community, we don't have the Native health services such as Tlingit and Haida, say in a lot of the communities, provides the Head Start. So we do have, thankfully, Chatham does provide preschool, but the other communities will be getting services for the 0 through 3 through these from the Native Health Corporations. We don't get that. We have the library, and the library serves everyone from the time you're born till the time you die. You can get services from the library. And of all of the feedback that we've gotten in written letters, it's all been for the library. And so if we are saying we want community input, I feel very strongly that we should listen to it and that we should fund the library, and that way that we have carryover and we take it either from that that emergency fund, and then when we get the carryover, you put it back and no one's had to stress over it. And so I think that that was one option. Another option is that the librarians have said that these monies that they need for their programs are so important that they're willing to cut their hours back to fund it. And so we have two options, and I'm suggesting that we choose one of them and fully fund the library.
If I might, a few things. You mentioned that you want to restore it back to what it was, but what it was a lot of extra funds that we had, and so that we no longer had. So that's for starters. The other issue is the amount being requested for library materials. You were mentioning Skagway. I'm not talking about, yes, they have twice the population that we do. They're in a borough. They get funding from the borough, as does the Bristol Bay borough that has two library branches and a higher payroll because they have two branches. None of those libraries with double the population spend close to what we spend on library materials. And what I'm trying to say is the doors are still open. The sky is not falling. There's plenty of library materials to be had and utilized. Cataloging all of those materials is a lot of work. And where we were, you know, fortunate during the times of having money to hire an assistant to do all that cataloging, our library administrative director is now cataloging all those materials. So the amount of work involved in doing those. In addition, I mean, if you can remove 800 books, and I understand the weeding process because we did it for years, and then add 800 books all within 1 year, That's kind of excessive in my mind. And the programs are still going to be met. The amount of programs and the amount of materials is what's in question for a community our size. And I feel like if you go back to 2019 and 2020 and you see the amount of money that was spent on materials, because they were spending the entire public library assistance grant on materials, which you don't have to do. So the amount per capita that we are spending on materials is a lot. And I have asked, so the third thing is, this is an emotional appeal, but I have asked for 2 years now for them to come forward with their needs based on the collection development policy and the prioritization of programs, not just we need this much this year because we had this much last year. We need to see a plan on the collection development policy and what your purchases are that you're making in relation to those policies, not just we need to have that much or we're going to have to close our doors, because I don't believe that they're going
No one has said they're going to close the doors. And I think that, again, it's the community seems to be very much behind it. And it seems like it's really not that big of an amount in our budget, but a very large amount for the programs.
And when we get a justification on that, then we can show what the justification for that is.
Real quick, Rachel has her hand raised.
Hi, yes. I just want to say that bottom line, this a budget is a budget and everybody is getting cuts. And yeah, it sucks for everybody that is getting cuts. And I think, Janine, I think you make a wonderful spokesperson for the library and that's nice and stuff. But the bottom line is the bottom line. And if Kathy is asking them repeatedly to back their request with information, hard facts, and not just heartfelt please, then they should do that. And maybe they would meet their requested budget. But bottom line is bottom line. You can't just say, oh, we have millions of dollars in our savings account. Let's budget to that. That's not how it works. It's about income and expenses. Bottom line. Thank you.
So I hear what you're saying there, but I think you have perhaps been misled that there are cuts everywhere, because like I just stated, the road maintenance budget got a 9.7% increase last year. So there's been some things maybe get misconstrued a little bit there, which is why I'm currently adding a formula to my spreadsheet so that I can look and see what the actual percent change year over year from budget to budget is. Cause I think, and then, you know, you get into like requested got cut from, so it's still a little bit murky there. I think there's a point to be made on both sides. So I'll start by addressing what Janine said, where we've gotten lots of letters and there's certainly a lot of emotional appeal around making sure the library is fully funded. We all know people in Gustavus love their library. I am one of the people who loves the library. I'd love to see the library get everything they want in the world. But then at the town hall, most of the comments we got at the town hall were about how we're spending too much money on labor. And people specifically pointed out, how are you spending that much money at the library? So I think I left the town hall kind of surprised at how I don't think a single person who attended, and we had maybe 30 people, 40 people, I don't know how many people came, not a single person said anything about, you know, where's the money for the library. I'll say that big picture, it's definitely a lot of strife over like $3,000 when we could just recognize $3,000 more of interest income and just give stuff to them. But it's also hard not to agree with Kathy on, you know, we should have some kind of justification for the funds that are being allocated. The library is not closing. The books aren't coming off the shelves. You know, how many, I'm curious to know how many less, like if they can quantify this cut in a tangible way of, you know, how many less books does that mean? What actual changes does this mean to the program? Or maybe we can find something in the middle where we do cut the hours at the library and use that to fill the budget, you know, put the librarians back down 5 hours like they were before COVID. I believe someone mentioned that there was an increase in the hours during COVID.
Yeah, additional 5 hours per library.
And then maybe we're striking a balance somewhere in the middle where, yes, we're decreasing our labor budget and that money can go towards materials. And I mean, at the end of the day, the spending stays the same as what we've budgeted, and we're kind of appealing or appeasing both sides here. So, I think the things we heard in the town hall were road maintenance. I think a couple people mentioned like fire hall and social services and making, but mostly it was road maintenance is what I heard in the town hall. So it depends on, and I think this is another part of why it's important for us to get a cross section of, you know, as broad of a set of people as we can in these events like the Coffee with Council, because it, even in a small town like this, it's kind of easy to get in your silo and hear what you hear. So I actually appreciated the diversity of opinions that I don't normally hear that side of things at the town hall. So it was refreshing to me. That said, I, you know, big picture, I would say this is a lot of strife over what's essentially like $3,000 when we really could just recognize more interest income and get the materials budget that they need. I would like to see them define the need a little bit more clearly, other than, because I mean, the COVID money is not here anymore. So go for it, Jim. Sorry. I'm just jumping around here.
Give him the gavel.
Yeah, playing chair for a day. Mm-hmm.
I think Jim Makowiak.
Yeah, okay. Just a general comment. You know, we talk about interest income, but there's inflation. And one of the things that interest income should do is to offset inflation. And like the state of Alaska, inflation proofs the permanent fund. So we shouldn't recognize all of our income or our income from interest as being spendable. You know, a certain portion of it should be saved based on what we think inflation would do. But that's my only comment.
Can I speak to that? Just so that is, Jim, I know it doesn't cover everything, but the reason why we didn't want to take any money out of the repair and replace is because I have suggested that leaving that interest there, inflation proofs the repair and replace fund. So we are aware of that. I want to say one more thing about the library, because I'm not emotionally attached to any of this at all. And I definitely don't want to pick on the library, but I did start my meetings with each department with, and not just my meetings, but the email that preceded it with, don't come and say that I want this amount of money because this is what I had last year, because you can say that to me and I can put that into the budget, but that is going to fall on deaf ears as it goes up the line and we realize we don't have enough money to cover everything. So make sure and justify your needs. And each department did for the most part, but the librarians, after sitting down, at least with Kathy and Shelley, it seemed like maybe a few $1,000s could get cut off of library materials based on what they were being told. So everybody's saying the same thing, show us why you need $14,000 for library materials and we can use interest income or surplus or anything else to cover this. To say that I want this because this is what we had last year, you could go back to 10 years ago and say, well, you didn't even have half of that. So, you know, at some point the income well starts to run dry and you have to figure out where you're going to cut. And I don't think that cutting your hours to get more materials, yeah, that works, but is that really a solution to the problem? I don't think so. It's if you need $14,000, then just show us. The fire department said this is exactly how much money we need for this. And so, you know, we made cuts, but not to the things that they had to have.
Well, and I'd like to point out the transparency level of this. Like if you go back several years, which I've looked at, it was down to $11,000, and that was before COVID money came into play. To get extra money for a few years in a row and then to say, okay, we're getting cut now when we don't have that available is a bit of a misnomer, and it's a bit misleading because some of the people who have written letters actually worked at the library before. And when I said, well, do you remember when you used your PLA grant to not just buy library materials, but, you know, to help pay the fuel bill or the light bill, they were like, well, yeah, because, you know, we had to do that. And I'm like, okay, so you never used $7,000 of the full amount of that grant for library materials. And so taking a step back, I know I gave the spreadsheet out about what other libraries our size or even double our size. I mean, Skagway may have a bigger budget for personnel, but they spend $5,927 on library materials in their library in FY22. And they're double our size or more. So I'm asking to look at what those needs really are and to give us some data on the circulation of all of the books and the materials that are being circulated by spending all of this money. And maybe if by, you know, March or April, it's like, okay, we don't have any money for books anymore, so we're not going to be able to buy these books, then yeah, let's look at that then. But like Ben said, he has asked also to just base it on a projection of real need And I feel like we need to get back to where we were pre-COVID and start looking at that. When the PLA grant was not included in the general fund budget, the council had no idea that that additional $7,000 was being spent on library materials. It just looked to them like we were spending $2,500 on library materials. And then all of the subscriptions were in the dues and fees, which were, you know, was, which also wasn't transparent. Now this is transparent. I can tell you that, you know, it's a lot and it's excessive. And when we get to the point where we see what's happening with all of that, then we should move forward. You know, we had to have like less things too. It just makes it look like that was the only the only entity that took any hits. We did the stuff internally before it ever got there. So I feel like there's a, you know, a bit of misleading information being provided to get, you know, to draw some of these letters and these concerns in, and that we're not going to be able to do all the things we've been able to do. And I don't think that's the case. And I ran the library for 16 years and I was a huge supporter of the library. And even I think it's a little over the top. So that's where I'm coming from here. And I want to see some hard facts
the library as it was 25 years ago is a different thing than it is today. Sure. And so I think we need to realize that. And so we are looking at, so the numbers, the $900 in the program supplies is a 31% reduction. And then the amount of reduction for the materials is 21%. That's a big chunk out of someone's budget.
But it's not 21% from pre-COVID amounts. That's what I'm trying to say.
Maybe this is an opportunity for me to talk about the federal funding. Back in FY21, we had $152,000 in federal funds. That started, we started increasing in FY22. In FY23, we had $691,593 in federal funds. Then it dropped down again in FY24. And this year we, for FY25, we're down total $195,000. So back in FY23, when we had $600,000, the librarians were each given 5 additional hours per week and raises of $5 an hour. It's just, we don't have the money that we had back then. And it's something that we just have to take into consideration in assessing our needs and then applying the money that we have to the needs. I'm sorry, go ahead. You wanted to go next, I think, Kyle.
It's all right. Thank you. I, you know, I've been kind of involved in this topic for a little bit over a year now, and going into this meeting, I was much aligned with Janine as far as, you know, it's only $3,000. What's the big deal? And hearing the articulation from both Ben and Kathy makes a lot of sense. And I've got to say that I wholeheartedly agree that if we need additional materials, or we want to keep we need to articulate the need. We need to defend the ask, and I don't think that's a lot to ask for what's going on. And as a personal supporter of the library, and an advocate for the people's voice, I have looked at this deeply, and really, really dug deep into this. And how can we do this? And especially when people reach out to us directly and have their thoughts, that is one of my biggest concerns. And ultimately, I'm erring towards that. But bottom line is, I think if we have an ask, it needs to be defended. And if we can't defend that, we have to tighten up.
And that was my intention in the beginning. Actually, my intention was to avoid this completely. You know, it's hard to be the person that has to figure out where, you know, hey, this is how much money we have, where do we make the cuts? And then to have to tell people, like, hey, this is where we're making the cuts. But unfortunately, you know, I want to say, I actually joked earlier today, like, just tell me where to make the cuts. You know, like, we can cut $3,000 out of ambulance supplies right now and put it into library materials. I know we're not going to do that, but I don't know, there's just there's just nowhere else to do it from. And we keep pulling money. I wish that our budget was way more conservatively budgeted this year than it currently is. But in order to fund the needs of the city, this is where we find ourselves. And unfortunately, some cuts had to be made. And it would have been harder. It would have been harder to do if there was a piece of paper in front of me that added up to $14,000 and said, this is why. Then it would have been like, okay, well, see what the council says. But, without that information, it just seems like maybe $11,000 will work, and honestly, I'm not getting as much pushback from the librarians as maybe there as the community is hearing, because, I'm not. And so I don't want to single anybody out, but I just don't think that some people think that the library is going to be able to get by just fine with $11,000 for library materials. And, nobody's taking credit for the program supplies cut. That might have been an error on my part. If Shelly and Kathy didn't cut it and Melissa and Leanne didn't agree to it, then maybe I typed the numbers wrong when I put it in there. I don't know. Nobody else is taking credit for that. So maybe that's my fault. And maybe that $975 needs to go back in. I don't know. That's, but as far as library materials go, I don't think that cut's going to, it's had to be cut from somewhere.
Thanks, Ben. And I really appreciate that explanation of that process and even just wrestling with that. And, this whole thing, because this isn't the first year this has come up. Although there were a couple of helpful suggestions as to why we're also, in this juggling act where we do hear things from Coffee with Council, from the public, of, simplifying the operation. And so we're getting hit from all angles here. And while I appreciate the advocacy from everybody reaching out to us, a lot of it was just, please support the library. We support the library. And there wasn't really a lot of helpful information as to how. There was a couple, I'll give it that, but ultimately, without being able to defend the need, like you said, you'd have a much harder time doing that if you had a piece of paper in front of you saying exactly why you needed that.
And, we don't have people, maybe because they don't realize it, and maybe because, our landfill manager, our DRC manager isn't out, lobbying for the hours that he lost or the hours that the Marine Facilities Coordinator lost, and nobody's writing letters about that, but that's because it's not, they're just dealing with it, and they're going to, and working within what they have, because they also had to give up a little. And so again, there's other folks who would love to have stuff added back into their budget too, but they realize that we have to do what we have to do.
So I'm not trying to curtail the library discussion, but you did mention the DRC, and that's one thing that I was a little bit taken aback to hear initially, that 200 hours were cut out of his budget request. And I haven't heard anyone, like you said, no one's written a letter about it, but I do want to just briefly posit or express a concern. Do we worry at all? I guess, are you confident that Ian is in a strong and sustainable position, that we're not going to be burning him out, or working him too hard? Because I think that's a really important position for us to make sure we're supporting adequately. I'll write a letter for the DRC, I guess.
Okay. And we've had that discussion. Trust me. We've talked about that. We're hoping that, first of all, it's hard to find people to consistently stay there. He manages so far. We hope that with the expansion piece, that he did budget some hours as part of that project for putting the fence in. And so we're hoping we can mitigate some of that with some of those hours as an alternative. If he needs more, we'll be coming back and asking for more. But no, I do not want to burn him out either. And I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's just make sure he's supported. And I think that it's worth noting in all of these cases, you know, with the DRC, as with the library, if we have a clear need and that can be expressed in dollars and cents, it's more than likely that we're going to have a surplus. And I think we've got a council that's more than happy to oblige any legitimate need that's expressed to us with a budget amendment down the line, especially once we know how much surplus we have. So that's that. I guess that's where I find myself coming back to almost every time with the library, you know, over $3,000. I go, gosh, we could just so much strife for, well, for something that we can really fix down the line with the budget amendment. If we somehow have burned through $11,000 and there's like the book that we have to have 20 copies of or something, then we can do that.
And I've written a letter to the superintendent about helping out with summer reading if they want to replace it with summer school, you know, for the Reading Buddies program. I've reached out to try to find additional sources of funding as well.
And Mike has his hand up.
Yeah, I think for the purposes of the work session, we've all got a pretty good idea of what the views and the issues are here, the considerations. And this is the kind of thing that a council has to do when they're approving the budget, is considered somebody's wishes to increase this or decrease that. And we do that in the general meeting. So I'd suggest that the way forward is not more discussion in the work session, but rather if Janine wishes to make an amendment to the budget, she can do that when it's on the table in the general meeting, and we'll vote on it.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, duly noted.
All right. Well, maybe we can move on to items 15 and 16. 15 is an NCO. Oh, well, let's see. We have the budget amendment of departmental budgets.
Yes. So this is basically what we've been talking about all along. Every year, this time of year, we do a budget amendment for the fiscal year that we're currently in to get everything back into line. Last year, with it being my first year and not having been the person who, last year we had more things that needed to be amended. This year, I just wrote them down. I don't have the NCO ready because I've been caught up doing other things, but, basically this year's budget amendment for all departments, the audit ended up costing more than we had initially budgeted for in FY23 and then rolled over into FY24. So we'll need to make an amendment, or part of the amendment will be to make up for that cost. The bank service charges, which we talked about the last meeting, obviously they came in way over what we had budgeted for because we just didn't know what that was going to look like with the new portal. Now we do, and so I need to adjust FY24's budget for that. There's a little bit of travel and training that we've done that's cost more than we expected, and a few of the departments need to have their utilities budgets amended slightly. We'll get everything to within 10% of the budgeted of what we originally were hoping to do, and that'll be the budget amendment. So I apologize for not having that ready, but I will have it ready for the packet, which you guys can see, and then we can talk about it at the general meeting.
Any questions?
No.
Okay.
I did have one quick question. So looking at the most recent version of the budget that you've shared with us, you mentioned that the audit came in more expensive than you had anticipated. Is that was under contractual services other, and is the line item? Oh, no,
no,
not.
It's administrative costs. The only line item was in administrative costs was the audit.
So that's not amended in our draft budget that we have here. Gotcha.
No, this is FY24, not FY25. We're amending. Yes.
Yeah, I just wasn't, for some reason, I think I had the number from contractual services in my head, and I said, oh, yeah, I remember the audit coming in at like 41,000, but I just didn't. And it crossed my wires.
It actually came in at more than that. There was, I don't know, I guess in this, I went back and looked at the previous audits. I guess this is just one of the things, but you pay them for typing and things like that, which are not included in the original contract. And so I'll have the exact amount on the amendment, but it came in over $45,000. And, you know, and looking back too, even say the last one, I think was in FY16 or FY17, it was that much then as well. So it's not that it's getting more expensive. It just, you know, I guess that's just an expensive process. We all went into the wrong business, apparently.
Yeah. So, you get paid for typing.
Yeah.
I guess, yep. I can kind of do it.
But would you add that on top of a invoice? I don't know. But
it's $20 an hour additional.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay, so that brings us to the last NCO, same old road drainage improvement project. And I don't know if Mike or Kathy wants to give us a summary of this. Okay. Mike, can you speak to this?
Okay. And I don't have the actual numbers here in front of me, but we've approved the scoping document for this project, and we've had our contracted city engineer develop a cost estimate and do some, you know, scope design on the project to determine what do we really have to do. And he's come up with an estimated cost for the project, which is more than I had originally written in the scoping document. But as we looked at it, as he studied the road and the plats, such as they are for the subdivisions along it, it was evident that the road is not entirely within the right-of-way. And so ditching along the east side of the section north of Tim Sunday's is going to require that we edge the road over a little bit. And so we'll probably be constructing the road, moving it a little bit to the west it's a matter of 2 or 3 feet or something like that to give us enough room for a ditch and to make sure that it is properly located within the easement. And that may actually require some survey work to determine exactly where the boundary is along Glenn Parker's subdivision side. So John Berry built some extra cost in for doing that for the survey and for the idea that we're going to actually have to cut some trees along the west side of the road there, and we'll be ditching a little farther over to put the road more with, you know, better within the easement. So Kathy, I think, has the an estimate of what we need for an NCO to give us enough money in place in the project to proceed with the putting out an RFQ and contracting it. So I guess that's what I could explain about it.
So the estimate, if I might, that we had with a little bit of the increased cost came to about $59,000. And we'll put that NCO forward to be posted in the general meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Kathy. Are there any questions? Any comments? All right. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of Monday's agenda, Madam Clerk.
Real quick, if there were any council members that are planning on giving updates, you don't have to necessarily do it now, but if you could just let me know before you leave or send me an email this evening for those of you who are on Zoom, just so I can include those in the packet for next week.
All right. Thank you. Okay, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for sticking in and listening to us. It's coming up on 8:10, and this is the end of the work session. Good evening, everyone.
Thank you all.